Les colloques du Collège de France.
So, good morning. First of all, allow me to thank Professor Besson for the invitation. It's really an honor to be here among such distinguished experts. Now, I will invite you to think about my speech. Let me see if this seems okay. As a call that I make to states to give the common heritage of mankind a second chance of success, to give it an opportunity to be considered as the governing doctrine to regulate the upcoming area of space resources utilization. Now, obviously, I'm not naive. I know very well of the obstacles that this option present and the opposition that the common heritage of mankind has received over the year. However, there are two reasons why I think that the common heritage of mankind should be given a second chance. Maybe I use this. Yes, okay. First and foremost, the common heritage of mankind is no longer what it was in the 70s or in the 80s. It has evolved and is a turn into something way more pragmatic than it was once was, losing some of its most controversial element and becoming, in my view, an instrument to achieve some specific target. And this revised and updated version of the common heritage of mankind rendered it more acceptable to a larger number of states. Secondly, embracing the common heritage of mankind, in my view, remain the most advisable, if not the only way, to make sure that the upcoming era of space resources utilization is conducted in a sustainable, lawful, and peaceful way. And why do I say that? Based also on the discussion that we had yesterday, the legal regime to govern space resource utilization is evolving into a rather controversial manner through unilateral initiatives, minilateral regimes, maintaining the fundamental disagreement on what is allowed or what is not allowed, with countries having different priorities, some favoring scientific activities, others pushing for commercial operation. And even at international level, at COPOS, like we have discussed yesterday, there are international discussions, but these discussions are affected by political motives, strategic initiatives, which may ultimately compromise the ultimate result. Hence, common heritage of mankind may be the solution, and I will try to elaborate on that. Now, my presentation will be organized as follows. First, after a few definitions, we look at what the common heritage of mankind once was, how it was elaborated originally, then as it has evolved, and how it has been applied in the law of the sea, and how it has not been applied in outer space. And then, based on our assessment, I will then make plead the case to use it to govern the future activities on celestial bodies. Okay, so let's start off with definition. I always like to start with definition because it is important to set the stage for what we are discussing. So, common heritage of mankind may be defined as a principle of international law dealing with the management and utilization of areas beyond national jurisdiction and the resources contained therein. Now, from a legal point of view, it is basically an evolution of the Res Communis Omnium doctrine, according to which areas beyond national jurisdiction are not appropriable by states, but they are open for access, use, and exploration, and the resources contained therein can be used and exploited within certain limits. Now, the common heritage of mankind goes beyond that, because yes, what is labeled as the common heritage of mankind area is not appropriable. However, this freedom no longer exists, so the area can be accessed and used only in accordance of principles agreed by countries, by the so-called international regime, often taking the face of, I think, the shape of an international authority. And this regime also dictates some behavior, among which you have the benefit sharing, potentially transfer of technology, and the preservation of the environment. Now, the common heritage of mankind has found application in two domains, the law of the sea and outer space. Law of the Sea Convention and the Moon Agreement. The fundamental difference between the two regimes and the two instruments listed over there, is that the Law of the Sea Convention elaborated way more the common heritage of mankind as compared to the Moon Agreement, okay? And as you see there at the end, the original version from 1982 of the common heritage of mankind has been evolved in 1994 through the implementation agreement of Part 11. Now let's see what it was originally. 1982, Part 11 of the Law of the Sea Convention declare Article 136 that the seabed beyond national jurisdiction, the area, and its resources are the common heritage of mankind. An international seabed authority is established with the task of administering the mineral resources of the area. And also there is, at the time, there was an imposition of mandatory sharing of benefits and also of technology from developed to developing countries. There was also an envisioned system of exploitation of resources through a parallel system, by means of which the authority would act through its armed enterprise. Okay? Now, even though this regime was, or this instrument, this convention was negotiated with all countries, as soon as the text was finalized, developed countries rejected this approach, describing it as against their interests. And shortly after, what was also mentioned yesterday, a disputing state regime was developed by a limited group of countries led by the United States, according to which a country would recognize each other mining claims through domestic initiatives. While that was happening, however, there was effort to negotiate an amendment to Part 11, which resulted into the 1994 implementation agreement of Part 11, which eliminated some of the controversial elements, including the mandatory transfer of technology, and it overall took a more market-friendly oriented approach. Okay. This led to several developed countries to ratify the convention, with the exclusion of the United States, that remain a non-party. We have discussed this all yesterday, so I'm run through this. No? The Moon Agreement, second international instrument containing the common heritage of mankind. Now, the Moon Agreement was drafted with one goal, to fill the gaps left open by the other space treaty in relation to the exploration and use of celestial bodies and their resources. Okay? This is not a surprise. Why do we have five space treaties? The first one laid down the legal foundation for the human activities in outer space. The remaining four provide a more detailed elaboration of specific topics, liability, registration, and in this case, celestial bodies activities. The Moon Agreement embraces a multilateral approach to the management and utilization of resources for commercial purposes, which is rooted in common heritage of mankind. One element that was not included discussed yesterday, but I think is very important, and it goes back to what I will say later on. The agreement has a limited number of ratifying states, but they used to be 18, now they are 17. Why? Saudi Arabia, a couple of years ago, decided to withdraw from the agreement. This is the first in the history of space law of a country withdrawing, and we will discuss why that happened. Very important for my presentation. As said yesterday, no major space party, spacefaring nation is a party to it. So no China, no United States, and so on and so forth. What did I do? Let me see. Now, as I said earlier, the Moon Agreement doesn't really elaborate the common heritage of mankind very much. It's very limited what it says. It simply declares that the Moon and its natural resources are the common heritage of mankind. However, unlike the Law of the Sea Convention, a legal regime to govern the exploitation of resources is not established. Even the common heritage of mankind is not really fully explained what it really is and what it really means in this context. There is simply a commitment for parties to at least initiate a discussion of this regime once the exploitation becomes a realistic possibility. Okay? There are, however, some principles that are indicated of what this regime should contain, including the controversial, no? Equitable sharing of benefit, which, however, here is way more softened than in the Law of the Sea Convention, because you see it takes into account the interests of both developing and developed countries. So those who have contributed, those who have mined, should receive their fair share of benefits as well. Article 7 is not part of Article 11. However, one of the innovations of the Moon Agreement as compared to the other space treaty is the fact that it pays attention on the environmental impact of human activities in space. So it basically says that if states engage in lunar activities, they should not cause harmful interference to the lunar environment. And that's pretty much it. The agreement, however, was not successful for various reasons that I cannot elaborate here, it would be too long. But you can look at the timing of the agreement. When it was ready, there were no lunar activities at all. Disagreement of what it meant, common heritage of mankind, and political factors. Just to mention one, the change of the American administration from the Carter administration to the Reagan administration, everything changed. Now, let's go to some more interesting stuff. So, recent development in the law of the sea and outer space when it pertains to the common heritage of mankind. So, some of these elements have been discussed yesterday, but I will try to take a different, put a different spin on it. So, the common heritage of mankind has been used to implement Part 11 of the Law of the Sea Convention, as described earlier, but also it has been embraced in other instruments. At the same time, however, we see, as we also we mentioned yesterday, unilateral initiatives are going in the complete opposite direction than the common heritage of mankind. Outer space will be a very interesting case, where you have, as we have listed earlier, numerous initiatives that completely go into the opposite direction than the common heritage of mankind. But my attention will be more on the controversial behavior of the Moon Agreement parties, that rather than promoting the Moon Agreement, have taken other ways. No? And we will elaborate on that. Going back to that problem of one country withdrawing from the Moon Agreement. So let's have a look at the sea. Okay, so the common heritage of mankind has been implemented in the law, Part 11, and then the agreement on the conservation and sustainable use of marine biological diversity beyond national jurisdiction, the BBNJ agreement, and then, as I mentioned, unilateral initiatives going in the opposite direction. Now, Part 11, the International Seabed Authority is tasked to design a system of exploration and exploitation of the deep seabed resources and to develop all necessary rules. So far, through licensing, okay, so far the Seabed Authority has issued 15 year licenses to explore deep sea mining, and the key focus is on environmental impact of these activities. So when applying for a license, a company needs to present an environmental impact assessment plan. So far, no exploitation licenses has been issued. One of the reasons is because there is disagreement of what this rule should be. The Seabed Authority has been attempting to develop this rule since 2013, but no agreement has been possible so far. The two issues remain environmental protection and sharing of benefits, which is what the Seabed Authority is focusing on. Okay. The disagreement comes from the fact that it is not really clear what the impact would be on the deep seabed as a consequence of exploitation. But it's clear that from the perspective of the Seabed Authority, protecting the environment is of paramount importance, and the Seabed Authority has embraced the fundamental principle of environmental law, precautionary principle, sustainability, and environmental impact assessment. The second core element of the approach of the Seabed Authority is benefit sharing, which is intended to have both monetary and non-monetary elements. But there are no more forced means of sharing benefits. It's more about creating opportunities. So using these benefits to actually do some projects rather than, you know, spreading benefits randomly among all countries. Okay, one of the most recent proposals was, for example, to create a seabed sustainability fund to support public goods and conservation, again, to target and to fund specific projects. Okay, so overall, very briefly, obviously, the current approach of the International Seabed Authority to common heritage of mankind is an attempt to promote activities with preserving some core element of the original common heritage of mankind idea, eliminating forced behavior and focusing on environmental protection as a tool to ensure the safety of activities and consistency with agreed rules and enforcement. And also practical ways to understand benefit sharing. And this is why I refer to this as a more pragmatic approach to common heritage of mankind rather than the philosophical approach that you used to have in the past. Now, there is a new agreement that was also listed yesterday that embraced the common heritage of mankind, which goes to show, first and foremost, that this is an alive principle of international law that states still see the benefit of. And this is the agreement on the conservation and sustainable use of marine biological diversity beyond national jurisdiction. Of course, I cannot go into the detail, but the whole point of my presentation here using this is that to show again that common heritage is alive, no? And it basically followed the same approach that the seabed authority has embraced as well. So trying to find a compromise between promoting activities and preserving the environment and sharing benefits, okay? One interesting point is that the environmental impact assessment is way more detailed in this context than it is in the seabed authority regime. And there is a clear, detailed standard on how this assessment should be undertaken. And it is the responsibility of the state, which is promoting the activities or undertaking the activities, to conduct this assessment. And if the state deems that there is no risk to the environment, there is the possibility for other states to flag the situation. So there is a calling mechanism for review, okay, which is interesting. Also, from the perspective of benefit sharing, again, benefit is intended as monetary, non-monetary. But there are, again, opportunities that are created to implement the idea of benefit sharing. For example, there is a monetary benefit that are to be managed through a special fund, which is coming from high-income parties, so to have always fund available to sponsor project, to fund project, okay? Now, all of this will be fantastic. However, we have initiative going into a completely different direction, which we have discussed yesterday, with the United States taking the lead on this. One part has gone missing. I don't know why. There's supposed to be something there. But essentially, the United States has declared its intention to license any activity by any company willing to mine the deep seabed. Okay? And they issued this executive order in 2025, in March, saying we are going to expedite the process for reviewing and issued seabed mineral exploitation licenses and commercial recovery, okay? And there are companies that have already applied. Now, so ultimately, you see two different approaches. One, the emergence of a pragmatic interpretation, more focus-oriented approach towards common heritage. And on the other hand, unilateral initiative that have the potential to completely crumble any effort to implement the common heritage of mankind idea, because there is a potential domino. If the US start licensing activities, other countries may start licensing activities, and the whole thing will just collapse. Outer space, this is what I think is very intriguing to look at. There are no initiatives at the moment that are intended to promote, no, the applicability of the common heritage of mankind to space and to lunar resources in particular. The parties of the Moore Agreement are not undertaking any effort to specifically target to achieve that goal, either to promote the agreement itself or to promote the common heritage of mankind. And as we have seen, there are initiatives going away from what common heritage of mankind is. So there is any chance left. Now, let's focus on the parties to the Moore Agreement and common heritage of mankind now, then we will go back to that. So as I said, in recent years, there is no specific initiative by the parties to the Moon Agreement to promote common heritage of mankind, to govern lunar activities and use of resources. There is one exception, which was a statement, a joint statement by some of the parties to the agreement in 2008, statement to COPOS, but there was no follow-up. What I've seen, also in recent discussion in the Legal Subcommittee Working Group, is that the parties to the Moon Agreement refer to the Moon Agreement in their statement, and they call for an international regime, but they never mention common heritage of mankind, which is always very funny to me. And the controversial behavior for me is that several of them have joined the Artemis Accord. So this joint statement is very important to me. It was very significant when it came out because it was an attempt to explain what common heritage of mankind is now, I mean in 2008. And the core point is that the agreement itself does not preclude exploitation as long as it is consistent with the common heritage of mankind principle, no? And also praise the benefit of the agreement for its flexibility and so on and so forth. Now, we will go back in a second to the Artemis Accord and the parties, because we haven't talked about the Artemis Accord. So let me get there for a second, because that is instrumental to explain why the behavior of these parties is controversial. So we have seen this yesterday. I don't want to spend time on that. There are four countries that enacted national space resource utilization law, which essentially recognize the private appropriation of celestial bodies' resources and the possibilities for companies to be licensed domestically to do so. Consistency, like we've seen yesterday, is highly questionable, consistent with international law, but okay. Well, something was not mentioned yesterday, very important for me, is that in 2020, during the first Trump administration, the White House issued an executive order which basically bashed the Moon Agreement, saying the Moon Agreement should not be considered, cause uncertainty, is detrimental to any effort to use resources, should be basically trashed into the bin of history. There you go. That also led to the Artemis Accord, which I don't want to talk about today because we discussed at length yesterday, but essentially the Artemis Accord embraced the US view on space resource utilization that was presented by the US with the 2015 National Space Resource Utilization Law, which basically, as I said, allows private licensing for space resources activities. Now, the question, of course, there are so many questions. At the end, if you look at the Artemis Accord, what will be the regime to govern the utilization of space resources? A mutual recognition of domestic licenses, because the Artemis Accord do not say that clearly. And how will the interests of all countries and the province of all mankind be implemented? You don't know. What is the level of environmental protection? We don't know. And so on and so forth. So, to go back to the clash, parties to the Moore Agreement and Artemis Accord, to me, the problem are massive. And I wrote this extensively. So if you think of the Artemis Accord embraced the freedom of countries to use and exploit space resources, indirectly recognize private authorization of space mining activities, and it's not clear what are the limits of these activities. And remember that it is based on interpretation of the law by a country that has rejected the Moon Agreement. So the Moon Agreement, the Artemis Accord, are the product of the United States, which have rejected the Moon Agreement. Now, if you think of from the perspective of a country party to the Moon Agreement, they joined the Artemis Accord. So you're joining an initiative which is drafted by a country that has rejected the agreement to which we are a party to. Already that doesn't make any sense. But anyway, the Moon Agreement embraces a totally different approach. Common management, international regime, environmental protection. So the two are, to me, largely inconsistent. And this is why we had 18 countries and now we have 17. Saudi Arabia was one of the countries that have were party and signatory to both, and they see the inconsistency, and they decided to withdraw from the Moon Agreement. Now, do I still have time? Yes.
5 minutes.
Fantastic. Sorry, I'm long, but there's so much to say. To the final point of my presentation, after all of this analysis, how and why we should think of using common heritage of mankind to regulate future lunar activities. So in my mind, there might be three scenarios. One, space resource utilization governed by unilateral approach, unilateral initiative, multilateral regime, like Artemis Accord, or undertaken under an international framework based on a common heritage of mankind. Now, unilateral approach, do we really want this? Is it consistent with the law? I don't know. Is it desirable to have activities licensed domestically? They may be in contradiction with each other, operating under different principles. Is it going to be efficient? I don't know. There is, of course, a risk of forum shopping. We can debate if this risk is significant or not, but there is that risk. And I wouldn't say that this is, you know, an unlikely possibility. If you look at the precedent of the US, what the US is doing and all over the sea, there is definitely the risk that this will be the option that will regulate future lunar activities. Even the unilateral regime à la Artemis Accord has the problem that you are creating blocks, and you know that there is the Chinese initiative with around 20 countries that have joined that. So the principle established within the unilateral regime will be not legally enforceable to state non-participating in it. There will be, of course, uncertain limits to the activities undertaken, and the disagreement on the fundamental principle of space law would remain. No? So the common knowledge of mankind remains, at the end of the day, the only approach that is capable of fulfilling the mandate of the space treaty, even of the other space treaty, promoting activities while preserving the interest of all. And it can also enable the understanding of fundamental principle and the recognition of rights and obligations of users, because you can actually agree on what is allowed and what is not allowed. Now, how to do that? You should try to learn the lesson from the law of the sea and embrace this updated, pragmatic approach to common heritage, which abandons philosophical ideas and focus on achieving specific targets, specific goals, in particularly environmental protection and benefit sharing. It will also be important that the system is embrace adaptive governance, so it can review itself, can adapt itself, and the structure is kept minimal. The two core elements of this pragmatic approach to common heritage of mankind for lunar activities should embrace environmental protection and benefit sharing as the core principle. Environmental protection should be based on parameters to assess the environmental impact of proposed activities and should also lead to an environmental impact assessment. Benefit sharing, again, learning the lessons, should not impose mandatory sharing, but should create opportunities with practical initiatives. I would also say this, that if we can agree on environmental impact principles and formal benefit sharing, you don't really even need an international authority for space. Licenses could even be issued domestically as long as they are consistent with the international grid standard. No? And we could also use existing institutions to manage the system. I don't want to keep you any longer. It's just a lot of ideas. So thank you very much for listening to me.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.